Well, hey there. Welcome to The Real Podcast, hosted by Jason Kaliba. We think that real people are interesting, not just celebrities and superstars, but also the guy standing in line next to you at the grocery store and the kid beside you in church. We're passionate about sharing the stories and insights of those people, real people, so that you're challenged and maybe even inspired to grow. If you'd like additional resources or more information about our guests, check out our webpage at cochranalliance.com/real. So, let's get real.
Okay, here we go. I grew up in a pastor's home, and for those who are listening who understand church evangelical culture, there were two kinds of holy children that people could have. They were known as pastor's kids and missionary's kids, PKs and MKs. So I suppose, talk a little bit about what it was like growing up in a pastor's home with all the idiosyncrasies, blessings, and challenges that came along with that. But as a PK, I actually don't know much about the unique things of growing up in a missionary family. And so as I thought about the season and the kinds of people I'd like to talk to, I thought I would love to learn a little bit about what it's like to grow up in a foreign culture and experience growing up in a home where your parents are focused on bringing good news or relief or whatever it might be to people in overseas. So I am delighted today to welcome into the Real Studio two friends of mine, Jessica Ulrich and Heather Ann Wicker. Ladies, welcome to the Real Studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So rather than me blab away about who you are, just give us a little sense of what it is that is keeping you busy these days and who are the people you like around you.
So my name is Heather Ann, and some of the things that I'm up to these days are nursing school. So I'm taking my RN degree right now, and pretty full into that. I'm married to Adam. And we live here in Cochrane. We love spending time with family. We love hiking. And always manage to seem to find ourselves busy doing something.
Okay. And where is the next outdoor adventure planned? Where will you be?
Great question. I'm looking at some backpacking already next summer. And actually, I would love to go backpacking in Newfoundland.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, the East Coasters are cheering as they listen.
Yeah.
Jessica, who are you?
I am Jessica Ulrich, and I have been married to Joel Ulrich for about 9 years. We have three daughters, Maddie, Ava, and Presley, and they keep us very busy. And I also work for WestJet. I've been a flight attendant with them for over 13 years now.
Wow. I see. So are you a senior flight attendant, or you're just in the middle of the pack now?
Kinda. I'd say about middle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Obviously, as I've already mentioned, the theme of the day is growing up overseas, particularly with your parents involved in ministry. So, Jessica, maybe I'll start with you. Where did you grow up? What is it that your parents were doing in that environment?
Okay, so I was born and raised in Cote d'Ivoire, West Africa.
What's the city on your birth certificate?
Farakissidougou.
Wow, I can't even pronounce
it's,
that.
Yeah, it's a long name to spell. So I grew up, the first few years was in Telekoro, which my parents were kind of teaching there. There was a national school there, and they were teaching kind of like seminary and English to the national pastors there.
Okay.
And then moved to Concon, and they worked with the national church there. And they also studied the language Menica, which is the tribal language there. And then later they moved to Cote d'Ivoire and became dorm parents at our boarding school.
Okay. And were you a student at the school at that time?
Later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Heather Ann, where were you?
So I was born in Canada, but when I was 3, my parents moved to Ukraine for a year to study the Russian language, and then moved into Russia for the next, I guess, over the span of 14 years. It's always hard to gauge the number of years because there's furloughs in there, or home assignments, or whatever they're called now.
Yep.
But I spent about 11 years in Russia.
Okay. And there'd be only a few people listening that would actually know the places, but where in Russia? Because it's, we say Canada's a big country, but Russia takes the cake.
Yeah, it's massive. So Krasnoyarsk is kind of southern central Russia. So we were there and then a little city outside of it for a while. And then Ulan-Ude, which is about a 3-hour train ride-ish north of Mongolian border.
Okay. So harsh climate or similar to what we find here in Canada?
I would say similar to what we find in Canada. Maybe more like Edmonton or a little bit more northern Alberta, more than Calgary. But very similar. Ulan-Ude was a desert, so very dry there. But otherwise, in terms of the number of months that you get winter, it was about the same.
Okay. So just thinking about this, Jessica, being in Africa, you are a visible minority. Heather Ann, did you stick out when you walked down the street? Did people know that you were a foreigner or not?
I would say that depended on when in my childhood. Most of the time, no,
okay.
Though. And especially if I was actually by myself. Because my... You know, I dressed enough alike, I acted enough alike that people didn't flag me.
Okay.
If I was with people from North America, or even sometimes with my parents, we would get flagged more often. And I don't know how much of that was language or how much of that was just our relational interactions were different, kind of, you know, cultural subtleties. But like my parents would get asked if they were from different parts of Russia. Versus, you know, obviously you're American.
Canadian.
Yeah, well, everything was American. But, yeah.
So, Jessica, you have been gifted, and your sisters as well, with the prototypical North American blonde-haired look. And it would have been difficult to be incognito. What was it like being a visible minority in Africa? Like, did you want to go outside in the street, or did you dread it?
Yeah, I mean, that's all we ever knew, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got used to that.
Okay.
I mean, people would just come up and like pet us and stroke our hair and touch us. And, you know, it was, I think, yeah, probably something our parents had to get used to for sure. But for me personally, because I was born there.
That's just how it was.
It's just what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did have, I've really only been to Africa once, in Kenya, and I got a view from the other side finally. So I remember, we were in this small village, a fairly remote area in Kenya, which not a lot of North American people. Kids were still scared of me, which indicated to me that they'd never really come into much contact with white people.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember there was this mass of African school kids all dressed in uniforms. And as they came, I'm like, man, it sounds racist to say this, but like, how do you tell all these people apart? And as we kind of were having conversation in the classroom, one of the kids put up their hand and asked I think they spoke Kikuyu, and it got translated. One of their questions was, how do you people tell each other apart?
Yeah.
So I'm like,
true.
Oh, okay. So they're looking at us going, they all look the same to me. It's just training your eye to what people look like.
Yeah.
So let's start on the positive end. Heather Ann, what would you say you liked best about growing up in Russia? What do you think was of benefit and blessing to you growing up in that environment?
Yeah, there's a ton of different answers I could give to that question. I think one of the things that kind of, if I can branch that question into kind of two branches, one of the branches would just be the idea of growing up overseas had the benefits of just the variety of life experience, the opportunity to travel at a very young age, and just all the different kinds of people, like just as you were saying, of different backgrounds, different ethnicities, you know, the list goes on, and just the opportunity to be in deep community with all of those kind of people rather than just the visiting, right? Like it's more of a sense of belonging. So that's definitely a highlight. And then specific to Russia, I would think that one of the things that stand out is just the vibrant indoor life. Like we were talking about the climate earlier. So, you know, for 8 to 10 months of the year, you're pretty restricted in terms of what you can do outside, in terms of the number of hours. And so just the community that happens indoors, whether it's in your own home or in friends' homes, it's just something that stands out. Just lots of time with people and working on different, you know, whatever you're doing at home, but just that sense of, yeah, there's this vibrant, cozy insideness.
Jessica, what about you as you look back to, man, I'm really glad for that part of my life, what would you say?
I think the biggest thing would be probably the friendships that we made. Again, like being at boarding school, your friends became your family. So I think you learn to rely on them. And that just became your life. So, yeah. And then just probably that global view of seeing that side of the world and just, being blessed with those really rich experiences that a lot of people over here just wouldn't ever understand.
Okay. Let me just maybe bounce off that question. I remember in talking to your parents that there was a time that they were needing to send your sisters away from home at quite a young age, and kind of other North American parents saying, how dare you send your children away when they're that young? Did you get that experience, or were you with them when they were already leading at boarding school, or were you ever separated at a young age?
Yes, I left when I was 6.
Okay.
So it was just that first year, though, and then they ended up
coming to the school,
moving when I was in second grade.
Okay. Do you remember that year?
I do.
So talk to us about it a bit.
I remember just being so excited to go to school because my sisters got to go, and I just wanted to be with them, and I was. Yeah, I just always wanted, when is it going to be my turn? And so when it was finally my turn, my parents dropped us off, and it was, you know, in the neighboring country, so it took days to get there. And I think I was just all excited, and then I realized they're like, okay, we got to go now. And then it just all hit me that, oh, they're actually going to leave me, and I'm not going to see them for a really long time, and we wouldn't see them for 8 months of the year in total. But so, yeah, that all hit me. Luckily I had my sisters, you know, my oldest sister, she didn't have anyone when she first went. So I was lucky enough to have my sisters to rely on. And
were they in the same building as you, same room as you? What was that?
That first year, yeah, I got to room with Jody, the sister right above me. So, you know, they try to stick family together and to keep that.
So if you had a bad day or you're upset, did you go to your sister's? I think there was a dorm parent set up.
I would usually go to my sister's, but the dorm parents, I remember that first night just like sitting in the rocking chair with Aunt Janice. She was the dorm assistant who lived down the hallway, and with this other first grader, Emily Ness. And we sat in her rocking chair and just like cried.
I see. And have you talked since with your mom about whether she was crying all the way home?
Oh, yeah. No, I know it was much, much harder on them than it was on us. Just that guilt of sending your babies away. So I don't know how they did it, but it was also not, they didn't have a choice.
That was the
policy. That was the only option. Mm. So, very, very difficult.
And so, give evaluation. That's only 1 year, although it's your first year of school. Right. Are you a damaged person because you were separated from your parents that year?
Right. No, I am not damaged. I had a very good experience at boarding school. Again, different for anyone that you talk to. Mm-hmm. They would have very different, even my sisters, they all had different experiences. But I think we mostly, I had a very good experience.
Okay.
So,
and do you have a sharp memory from? I have only little snapshots of my grade 1 year, but do you have any memories that stick out besides that first night being upset?
I remember Sundays. We hated Sundays. I don't know, even to this day, I know it sounds bad. I just found them really hard days because it was the days you would get, you would write to your parents. So you wrote handwritten letters. Whether or not they got, I don't think they ever even got to our parents because the mailing system didn't really work. But my parents would write us each letters and pack them with, you know, they would give them to the dorm parents.
Before the year started.
Yeah, okay. And as if they were being written every week. And so we would get those letters from them, okay, like every Sunday. And so it was after lunch, noon rest period, and we would get those letters and just cry and cry. And there's always like a little like candy or something, like little treat in with that letter and stuff. So, yeah, those, it was like a bittersweet day because okay, you got to hear from them, but not, yeah, then you had to write back and it was, yeah, it was just very difficult.
It reawakened separation, yeah, every week.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that still plays into Sunday today.
Yeah, it does actually.
Huh.
And the food at the dining hall was not good on Sundays.
Because the cooks were off?
Don't know why. Huh. It was not good.
I see. So Heather Ann, tell us about education for you.
Yeah, so we were in the middle of nowhere. So boarding school would have been, like there probably would have been one in Moscow, but that was like literally four time zones away from where we were. So yeah, but I think honestly, my mom was actually a missionary kid.
Okay.
And so she never went to boarding school, but her older brothers did, in India. And so I think, you know, it's been a long time since I've, you know, explicitly had this conversation with my parents, but I think it was just their sort of, we're not having that as an option. Like we don't, you know, we'll do literally anything else kind of rather than do the boarding school thing. So I think when they were going to Russia, what that other option was in their mind was, we're here living alongside these people, we're ministering alongside with these people. Mm-hmm. Like we are, yes, we're still Canadian, but we are living as Russians, right? Like we are entering fully into Russian society
culture, yeah,
and the culture. Yeah. And so they were going to send us to school. And so I ended up doing 2 years of Russian kindergarten. It's kind of this weird construct of like daycare that kind of transitions into school that's a throwback to the communist era when, okay, you had childcare from when the kid was like 6 weeks old.
Oh.
So I think it was when I was 5 and 6. And those 2 years were really, really good for my Russian language.
Because you got fully immersed with the kids.
Fully immersed, yeah. And so my brother ended up doing 1 year and my sister actually didn't end up doing any, because I'm the oldest of three. And I think part of it was just, it was a really hard couple of years. Like I would come home crying every day. I have a few memories from those years, but not a lot. So I don't know if my brain just kind of blocked it out or what happened there, but I was also pretty young. So yeah, and so of course it was really hard. Again, I think harder on my parents than it was on me. Like I have some memories, but again, I don't think I was damaged as a result. But it was enough. The teachers didn't really know how to handle me, mm-hmm, we were the first foreign family living there. So the Russian culture is kind of based on, like, it's not a shame honor culture, but the way you discipline and provide correction is to yell at kids and, you know, why don't you act more like so-and-so? Look, they're doing everything right. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really with a lot of guidance. And so just the kind of the fact that it was very early, you know, it was early 90s. So the Iron Curtain had just fallen. Mm-hmm. They weren't really used to foreigners. And yeah, kind of all of it added up to where my parents were like, this is not a good option. Like, this isn't good for our kids, you know, emotionally, but also it's not good for us emotionally, but also just educationally, it's a very different education system. So they knew that we would have a hard time coming back to Canada if we were to do schooling in Russia.
And you were the guinea pig, whereas Jess is at the tail end of 4.
Exactly.
You're the front runner of 3.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So my mom is actually was a teacher in Alberta before they went into missions. So she calls herself a reluctant homeschooler because it was definitely not her first choice. Mm-hmm. But she did an amazing job and we have tons of amazing, wonderful memories of homeschooling years. So I can read, yeah. More importantly, I can cook. No, I'm just kidding. No, yeah, we were, and then when we got into high school years, Then online school was just starting to kind of become an option. So then high school was, we were able to kind of get into online system.
And was it like an Alberta curriculum or from somewhere else?
No, it was a bit of a hodgepodge. So my, again, kind of that guinea pig thing. I ended high school with no high school diploma, no standardized tests, but a good education. And my brother, I think he took the SATs and he took some of the AP placement classes. So they have, you know, you kind of have some things on paper that way. And then my sister went to Concord High. So kind of the reverse there of how that worked out.
So when you went to U of C, how did you get in? Or so you went to Ambrose?
First, I went to PRVI, to Peace River Bible Institute.
Yeah, and they would totally have like a
world. So they were totally like, sure. And so then I transferred to Ambrose, which was a little bit of a fight.
Okay.
So it hasn't been easy not having a high school diploma, to be honest. But other than a bit of a fight to get into Ambrose, after that, it's been no big
because
deal. Right?
Seen
I finished with a degree.
Stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I finished with a degree. And then for U of C, I'm a post degree student. So they don't care anything about high school.
Okay.
They just need to know that you have a bachelor's degree from somewhere else.
When you become a nurse, will you have to have that on your name tag? By the way, I don't have a high school diploma.
Sub-educated. Yeah. No, I enjoyed school, right? So I talked to, you know, some of my friends who went to school here in Canada, and I got to take history and, you know, social studies. My mom was an English teacher, so we did a ton of literature stuff that they just don't do.
And was Tolstoy mandatory?
No, actually, my mom hates Russian literature, so.
My mother majored in Russian literature
really?
In university, so
oh
she
goodness.
Needs to have a talk with your mom.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Okay, well, Heather Ann, obviously you picked up Russian. Jessica, did you learn any other languages?
So in ConCon, my parents were studying the language Manica, and I would run out and play in the sand piles and dirt piles, and picked up a lot of Manica those years just because I was a sponge, but then lost probably all of it when I went to boarding school. We spoke mostly English at boarding school, and French was the main language in Cote d'Ivoire, so I knew some French, but you didn't use it every day type thing. So again, lost a lot of it when we came back to Canada.
Okay.
So yeah, I wouldn't consider myself confident.
Can you do the bilingual announcements on WestJet flights?
Just a couple. But I wouldn't consider myself confident, especially on those Montreal, Quebec City routes.
How about best vacation? Where would you say you remember most?
There was a little place called San Pedro on the coast, and it was about a six-hour drive from the boarding school, actually. And we would always drive there, and there was a missionary guest house there, and we would stay and just play in the waves for an entire week straight. Huge waves.
Okay.
So, yeah.
How about you, Heather Ann? Did go anywhere cool growing up?
Yeah, lots. I mean, I think the highlight for me overall is just there were conferences that would happen in Europe. And so there would usually be a week that my family would tack onto that where we would do travel. So Germany, Hungary. We were back in Hungary a couple times. We went to England, which is where my dad's family heritage is. Mm. And then India, actually with my grandparents who were missionaries there. So that was really cool. We got to see where they did ministry. And yeah.
Okay. How about your best foreign moment? What sticks out in your mind?
Good question. Well, I think in terms of like a moment that I'm proud of would be, and I have only a very vague recollection of this, but when I was six, apparently my Russian was okay enough that I was the translator for my grandparents on this like tour that we went on with them.
Okay.
Like it was like a boat ride of some variety. And so apparently my grandparents and all the Russians were always super impressed to see this little quote unquote American speaking Russian. But I think that in terms of, you know, not as positive, starting that kindergarten that I talked about, they had English class in the kindergarten, like for the kids. And so this English teacher was not quite sure what to make of this native English speaking 5-year-old. And so I do remember kind of that awkwardness of being in the middle of like, okay, I'm not Russian like I don't belong here, right? Mm-hmm. And she's kind of like the spotlight was on me because, oh, look, this, you know, person actually speaks English. Mm-hmm. And that's just, that was just so outside of the frame of reference of any of the Russian kids or even Russian teachers. Mm-hmm. So I remember that being a very uncomfortable moment. And I don't know how great this teacher was because I don't remember this, but my parents say that I would come home and the teacher had been correcting my pronunciation in English so that it had a Russian accent. So thankfully, that's I didn't good. Retain a lot of that.
Any movie offers lately for playing
yeah, right?
Russian roles?
No, my Russian accent English is bad. Russian. Yeah. I should have paid more attention in class.
And how about food is always a great cross-cultural reference. What are you missing? Is there anything from your growing up years that you miss sometimes when you're sitting down for a meal?
Yeah, I'd say even the good old street food there was so good. There was the deep-fried plantains, which were called alikos, blofotos, which were like a deep-fried dough, and just these amazing meat sticks. I think the best part, though, was when it would rain, termites would swarm like any lights. So on the basketball courts, we had these huge lights, and we would just run through the court with bags and just collect like swarms of termites, take off their wings, and then fry them in salt and butter. And that was like the best snack. So I miss those.
Wow. What does it taste like?
Kind of like crunchy popcorn.
Okay. And you would still be able to do that today if someone offered you termites?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, we grew up on them. They were.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I need to try. I wouldn't have imagined that that's what the food you would have chosen. How about you?
Nothing quite as exotic. I think it's more just the context. Like there's a lot of foods that I can make here or have here, but there's you know, I can make, you know, fried potatoes and like macaroni and canned meat if I want to. But it's just I think it's more the context of like, you know, eating it in the backwoods in the middle of nowhere with 80 other people come on this ridiculously unplanned backpacking trip and where we barely had enough water and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I would say polzy they're actually a kind of Mongolian food, and they're a steamed meat dumpling. So you have meat and then dough around it, and then you steam it. So there's broth inside. So you have to take a bite out of the dumpling and then drink the broth and then eat the rest.
Oh.
So that with hot tea, you can't really have it with anything cold or it'll make the fat in the meat like solidify in your mouth. And that's just not a good feeling. So you have to have it with something hot. Yeah.
Cool. So how does the cultural differences or your MK self, how does that show up in contrast in your marriage? When has there been a time that that Adam goes like, what is up with that? And you realize this is the cultural dynamic.
Yeah. I'm laughing because you said a time. I think one of the things that I've realized is that has come up in our marriage is for me that sense of impermanence that just accompanies life. So when I got into school in January and started school, and that was maybe the first time ever, at least the first time in a very long time, that I had this sense of, I think I know where I'll be in 2 years. You know, other than that, it was the sense of who knows, like anything could happen. And even the summer, like I'm talking with my in-laws about Christmas plans, not for this Christmas, but for next Christmas. And that's just such a foreign concept to me, of that ability to plan ahead that far and having that stability. So I think that's one way. And then just sort of the differences in ideas of what life looks like, of like, you know, growing up in a missionary family context, there's sort of this sense of vocation that's just as regular to life as, you know, learning how to cook, right? There's kind of, oh, and then you learn what your calling is. And not that it has to be like a neon sign from the Lord, but life is assumed to be more, to be about more than just you go to work, you buy the house, you have the family and kids and the dog and the white picket fence, and then you die, right? Or then you retire and then you die. But there's, you know, there's more. There's a sense of what are you doing with your life within that.
Mm-hmm.
And Adam grew up with the white picket fence and the dog. You know, that sense of more, you find a career and you do that for 30 years and then you retire and then
you enjoy the fruits of your
the fruits of your labor. And so I think that's been a difference of, okay, but and part of that is just that the world is changing, right? There aren't a lot of people who do that 30-year career mm-hmm. anymore. Things change a bit more quickly, but just the difference of our cultural background and the differences in our family culture as a result of that and coming together. I think those are a couple of things that jump to mind.
Mm-hmm. Show up in your marriage, Jess?
Yeah, it does. I'd say even just on a lighter note of technology. I mean, we just, didn't grow up with technology whatsoever. So his dad's a computer engineer. He is very good with technology and computers, and I almost refuse to learn about it. And I know that sounds really bad because my kids are going to be, that's going to be their life. And he gets really frustrated with me when I just give up and I'm like, no, I'm not even going to try with this, computer or whatever. He gets pretty frustrated and I'm like, well, I'm from Africa. So
yeah, that's so funny.
You will eat termites that have been deep fried in salt.
You will like it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And I think even just like the cultural rules too, right? Mm-hmm. Like if there's a new situation, I'll be like, are we supposed to take a gift? Are we supposed to, bring a bottle of wine? Like what, how do we act in this situation? And he's like, oh, right. Like you don't have that cultural assumption mm-hmm. of what would be quote unquote normal.
Okay. Right.
In
yeah.
Canada.
Do you think, I'm transferring from your growing up experience to kind of this bridging the cultures thing. Did people stereotype you in any way? So sometimes you guys came home, was it approximately 4-year intervals for both of you or
mm-hmm.
so when you came back, now you're in your home, apparently home culture, your parents' home culture. Did you get treated differently? Did people stereotype you in any particular way?
Yeah, you get a lot of the questions of, oh, did you ride elephants to school? And do you live in grass huts? And is it hot there? Mm-hmm. And just, those typical questions that I didn't feel like I was any different until you start getting pelted with these constant questions mm-hmm. of, oh, I guess I thought that was normal.
Okay.
So,
yeah, I can definitely relate to that. Yeah. The questions especially, and I think my siblings and I definitely came to dread them of the, where do you like living better and how was your trip and say something in Russian.
Yeah.
You just, as a, 9-year-old, you just die inside. I can't. But I actually think that some of the stereotyping that I've more felt, I definitely relate to what you were saying, Jessica, about the, oh, I kind of just thought this was normal. I mean, mm-hmm. I knew it wasn't for people here, but is it really that different? You know, mm-hmm. you don't realize the water that you're swimming in, so to speak, mm-hmm. right, until it's different.
Right.
I think that actually in recent years, some of the stereotyping has actually come from fellow missionary kids.
Okay.
So, they'll be talking about, I'm trying to think of an example, well, even just like you went to boarding school, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, oh, well, how boarding school is, the missionary kid experience, right? And kind of like they're taking their story and making it all missionary kid experience. Mm-hmm. And then, kind of comes around to my turn and I'm like, well, actually it was different because of this, mm-hmm. like not kind of that stereotyping of, oh, well, all MKs are like this. Mm-hmm. I'm like, actually I'm not, or my experience wasn't like that or... Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that that's happened more, whereas with people who weren't missionary kids, it's less specific. It's more just kind of this general sense of differentness that they blanket you with, mm-hmm. of like, oh, wow. I mean, it's cool, and there's a sense of, awe that people give, mm-hmm. right? But it is a process of kind of you feeling set apart, mm-hmm. of like, oh, you're different.
Mm-hmm.
Because of your experience.
So maybe this is a good time to raise a term that I've heard, and I didn't hear it until, maybe the past 5 to 10 years at most, third culture kid. Can either of you kind of give me what your definition of what a third culture kid is and kind of what it means to you from based on your mm-hmm. experience?
Yeah, I think in general it just means someone that was raised, you know, by missionaries or like military personnel or someone abroad, basically not in your own passport country.
Okay.
Is like the technical meaning. But I don't know. I can't even really describe what, like, I think a third culture kid kind of makes their own culture because you can't really even describe it. Like, you just, again, you feel different from everyone else around you. And then coming back here, you feel like you don't belong back where you were. And it's hard to explain.
Okay. And is there a moment or an experience that would say, well, this is when it became, this is kind of when I felt like I felt the third culture kid dynamic in my life. Was there a moment that you have, or it's more a generalized thing?
I'd say it's more of a generalized thing. Just with coming back was awful. So, trying to transition back into this culture, was when I really realized, you know, it's a completely different world over here. And yeah.
That. So tell us about that. How old were you when you came back?
I was 13.
Okay.
And
why did you come back?
So the country we were in was blowing up politically. It was very unrest and unstable. And also my sister Jody had malaria, I think it was about 7 times within 1 year, and led to typhoid fever, and she just wasn't getting any better, and her seizures were getting worse. And so our mission was basically, like, the doctors were like, you need to go back to Canada and get some medical help for her.
Okay.
And literally all at the same time, the country, we had another coup d'etat where the military overthrew the government, and it just, the whole country erupted, and there was guns and bombs going off, like, right across the soccer field of our school. And it was just time to leave.
Okay.
So, yeah. So we came back, and my parents just wanted to regroup as a family and just focus on healing. And yeah, but actually it was the hardest.
Okay. Part. So you went back to public school in Calgary?
Yes.
Okay. So and you were in junior high?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So what was it like getting back into public school, or not getting back into, going to for the first time?
It was awful. If I'm going to be completely honest, our boarding school was very sheltered and very conservative. And so, yeah, we were very sheltered, and coming the first day of school was very eye opening. You know, people were making out in the hallways and swearing left, right, and center. So not hearing or seeing any of that was like, I know that sounds very sheltered, but
you thought you'd gone into like purgatory, some alternate reality or something.
Yeah. And, just the stuff people complained about. And like, I remember, you know, oh, I got the blue phone and I wanted the pink phone. And, you know, they're so mad at their parents, and I'm just shocked, like, that you guys have phones, like, you know, just their concerns were just, I couldn't believe it when, where I came from, people were literally starving and dying from malaria left, right, and center. And so, yeah, these, just this huge shock of culture, and people made fun of me constantly. And I mean, I literally walked into my first homeroom class and was introduced, and these boys started literally making fun of, like, all the bracelets. I wore these African bracelets up to my elbows because that was cool back where I was from. And they just started making fun of me. And it was like, just from then on, it was constant, and people just called me Africa. They didn't even learn my name. It was just, it was rough years. I think that's why I'm so close to my sister Jody, because we went through all those emotions together, and we would come home and just like bawl on our beds together because we just hated it here. Mm. So
I see. So your sister was a lifeline. Anybody or anything else that was a safe harbor?
No, honestly, like, I was very mad at God at that point, because I felt like he ripped us out of, like, everything we knew and every place we loved and all our friends and family, essentially. I just, it was a very extremely rough transition. So I felt like he had abandoned me. I felt like it was a good, I'd say, 5 years of just, you know, we went to church because we had to. Mm-hmm. And it was my family, whole family was healing. So it was pretty rough.
Okay.
But yeah, my sister and I'd say I felt like that's kind of all I really had to confide in.
But. Hmm. Well, I want to come back to that maybe, but Heather Ann, how old were you? And maybe a third culture kid from your experience, mm-hmm. how old were you when you kind of transitioned back? And did you already know what that would be like based on kind of some furlough experiences, or was it new once you were like in the metropolis of sex?
Grand Prairie. Yeah, exactly. definitely resonate with what you shared, Jessica. Like the experience of it was different, but some of the themes are similar. So coming back to this TCK concept, and you explained it really well. And one thing that I'll just tack on is one of the TCK MK gurus out there is Michelle Phoenix.
Okay.
So she's a blogger, speaker. She taught at Black Forest Academy, which is a boarding school in Germany, mm-hmm. for 20 plus years. She was a missionary kid herself. So she talks about this concept, and I heard it from her, so it may not originate with her, but that's who I'm crediting. The concept of, if you take culture A as blue, right? So Canada for me, and then culture B of Russia is red, then the TCK sort of culture is purple, mm-hmm. right? So it is a blend of the two, but you're going to also have purple, right? You're going to also have Canada and Cote d'Ivoire and, but you're going to have purple. So our purple culture is going to relate better to one another than it necessarily will to either of our red or blues, if that makes sense. So I think that's a really key point to the TCK identity, experience, cultural paradigm, is that sense that TCKs tend to relate really well to each other really quickly because they just get it right away. Because a lot of those themes are the same, right? The themes of grief and loss, but also the themes of, you know, the richness and the variety of life and the deep relationships with people who aren't family but are family, and like all of that. So I think for me, and just the common, some of the other common themes are just that global kind of more mindset, right? Like you were talking about with, okay, really, who cares what color phone you have? Mm-hmm. You know, there are literally people dying like right now. Or, you know, it's also a pretty common theme to be pretty overwhelmed by the choice that we have here in Canada, right? Like you in other countries that are, some of them very limited. You know, Russia was kind of more second world in terms of that first, second, third. But, you know, just trying to buy salad dressing to this day is sometimes still overwhelming. Like, there's literally so many kinds. And who cares? And do we need this many kinds? So I was 17 when I transitioned back. And that was right before my grade 12 year. So I ended up living in, living with my parents and finishing up my grade 12 year. That was a really hard year because I was kind of in Canada, but kind of not. Because it didn't make sense to transition to public school at that point. Like, I took math 30, I guess it is in Alberta, math 30, 20 and 30 at the high school so that I never had to touch math again. But other than that, I finished out, like, with the online school and the online community of friends, which I'm still friends with some of those kids around the world, some of whom I have met and in person and some of whom I haven't. So it was a hard year. I think partly because I was really busy, like, academically, and also partly I didn't really have a context that I fit in Canada. Like, we would go to youth group, but it was just like this other world and we were just putting in time. Like, my brother is 2 years younger, so he and I would go together and we were really just putting in time. So that first year was hard. It was the hardest thing in my life to that point. was saying goodbye to my family at the airport when they left at the end of that year. And that was one of the first, or maybe even the first time that I saw my dad cry, was saying goodbye to me there. And that was really impactful. Like he was, you know, hugging me, and I remember this sense of like realizing that he was hugging me because he needed it, not because he was trying to comfort me. I was like dad of five. I mean, not actually, I was crying too. And, but then realizing, oh, like he's actually crying here. So that was really hard. But I honestly look back at my transition as God being very gracious. At the time I was a little like, oh, I'm, you know, I've grown up overseas. I'm this big fish. I know the world. I don't need to be in this small pond of sex with Alberta. But I had to get some orthodontic work done that I hadn't been able to get done overseas. And so I needed to be within a certain radius of Edmonton to get to those appointments. And so that, and I knew I wanted to go to Bible school. So it kind of all just added up. But I think that like that was exactly where God had me at that point, was in that small enough environment. Like I think there was 120 students my freshman year, but that was by far and away as big of a social context as I could have handled at that point, of just learning how to navigate, you know, peer relationships in Canada. It was very different than Russia. So yeah, I did some weird things.
Do you have an example?
Well, I really like history. And we had visited earlier that summer some ancestral graves. And so I had taken grave rubbings, which is all fine and good, but most people don't hang a family tree on their wall in their bedroom, in their dorm room. Their families.
Yeah, grave rubbings on your
rubbings
wall.
Wow. So some people thought it was a little strange.
Did you have a gothic?
I know, not at all. I know, it's exactly what my husband said. He's like, oh, you little goth. That was far not that at all. So, but yeah, just things like that. And, you know, one of the things, I don't know if you found this, Jessica, but TCKs can tend to attract odd people, just to put it bluntly, because we are good at talking with a lot of different kinds of people. We do tend to have that compassionate, others focused, even if it's not necessarily intrinsic to who we are. It's a culture that we've been steeped in growing up, right? Of just that missionary ministry outlook
open
on life.
Open posture.
Yeah, exactly. And we tend to be, they're called edge dwellers. So in a social group, we're not the person right in the middle. We're kind of on the periphery, which is, you know, has its pros and cons. The pros being that we can easily navigate between social groups, but the con of that being that we don't necessarily have a sense of belonging to anyone. So we then, it's very natural to, for other edge dwellers who are edge dwellers because edge they're socially awkward So there are a few awkward situations from that, like guys that I had to tell I wasn't interested in dating.
But they just felt comfortable around
they
you.
They felt
so finally
like
there's a woman who actually handles me.
Exactly. So couple of situations like that. Yeah, but it was a safe environment to do that in, right? It was Bible school. It wasn't some massive 20,000 student body university where, you know, the playing field would have been a little more dangerous, honestly. So
okay. Let me ask you a little bit about your spiritual journey with Jesus. Being a pastor's kid, one of the stereotypes of my peer group is, well, if you grew up in a pastor's home, probably you're going to be a wild child or also like a real straight liner. But, you know, some of us are known for just have a distaste for our parents' religion and so on, go the other way. So talk to me about your relationship with Jesus, particularly maybe as a teenager, and what changed during the transition coming back into North America. Jess, maybe I'll start with you.
So again, our school was very structured in Bible classes and daily devotions and, you know, extra worship nights and outreach programs. So you were constantly immersed in that, getting to know God. And so I even back then, I almost felt like it was, you know, it was just something we did, and you kind of go through those motions, and that's just how it was, I guess. But yeah, it, I think it was more watching my parents just be these examples of just trusting in God, like during those very scary and violent times that we had there. Mm. So I guess just learning through them really was kind of where I learned to put how to put my trust in God. Mm. But coming back again, those years were rough, and I actually found church to be going to youth group was probably worse than actual public school. Mm. It was very, very cliquey, very hard to I tried to fit in as much as I could, and I don't know, it just felt, I just didn't belong anywhere. Mm.
Which is so very weird hard. For me, because I've talked to especially your dad, and like he is he's not a saint in that church community, but he's bedrock, right, in that church community.
Exactly.
And yet here you are in that same context, and it is not a great place for you.
Right. Yeah. Mm. It was very, very difficult. I don't think I felt, you know, comfortable or like I had actually finally forgiven God or my parents even. I was frustrated with them too. But I felt like I was finally adapted into this side of the world. Probably when I graduated high school and I went to Ambrose.
Okay.
I just did a year and a half of general. I was supposed to go into nursing actually. But then Joel proposed, and then I ended up putting him through doctorate school. So that all changed. But anyways, once I kind of made those solid friendships at Ambrose again and met Joel and, you know, got on with WestJet, I finally felt, I don't know, like I was worth something on this side of the ocean, and like I had a place and a purpose. So yeah, it wasn't until then that I feel like my faith kind of renewed.
Okay.
Sort of.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Heather Ann, how about you?
I would definitely resonate with this, you know, it was just kind of something that you did. Mm-hmm. I think that my wrestling began when I was in my mid-teens. Mid-teens. And, you know, before that, I'd accepted Jesus into my heart and at least once or twice, you know, just to be sure. but then in my mid-teens was when it began to be a sense of, okay, I need to make this my own, and I'm not, you know, wrestling with assurance of salvation and how can I know that I'm saved. And in looking back, I think there's, you know, just the growing pains of that were just part of adolescence and potentially also some spiritual attack going on just because of the environment that we were in at the time. But so it was a couple year process, I would say, but and still kind of participating at the time, but kind of this sense of like I'm not fully in. Mm. And I need to make sure that I'm fully in before I say that I'm fully in.
Okay.
And so my parents were a huge part of that. Like I would talk to them. They would, you know, and they had definitely had room for my questions and room for my doubts. And I think they were kind of the main people in my life at that point that I would actually, you know, talk about what I was wrestling with. And then, yeah, kind of had a turning point in my later teens of just, okay, no, I'm going to allow Jesus into the process of this. You know, mm-hmm. even if I don't have all the answers, I don't have to have it all figured out, but I know that he's good, and then I can say, hey, can you come in and help with all these doubts? Because I don't, you know, they're too big for me. Mm-hmm. And just the overwhelming sense of peace that came with that prayer that I still remember. It was at camp on Lake Baikal, which is where we had camp in Russia. Mm-hmm. And I was baptized actually in that lake a year and a half later. And that was, you know, also a significant public declaration. And it's also culturally pretty significant in the Russian church, because that's when you can start taking communion.
Okay.
That's when you're considered a full member of the church, is after your baptism. Okay. So baptism, they don't usually baptize kids or, you know, they're older teens, mid to older teens kind of at least. Mm. So But then I would say that, yeah, the process of my faith kind of becoming my own, and actually what does it mean to have a relationship with Jesus? What does it mean to do life with Jesus every day rather than just, you know, sort of these big ideas? That was definitely the kind of groundwork for that was laid in Bible school.
Okay.
So that was, I'd say, when, you know, my personal faith really was rooted, was in that time. And yeah, kind of planted earlier and then rooted and started growing and really in Bible school.
Let me maybe turn the perspective from looking internally at yourself to looking at your parents. So both of you now are women on your own career path. You're married. Jessica, you're into family life. Being a missionary, what's your evaluation of what that was for your parents? Did it make them better people? Was it all sacrifice? How do you evaluate the impact of cross-cultural work on your mom and dad? What's your thoughts there?
Yeah, so, I mean, they literally uprooted and went to the jungles of West Africa in the middle of nowhere. So they sacrificed, yeah, a lot. All their family here, their home, their actual family, just by sending us to boarding school, a lot of that sacrifice, just trying to constantly feel that, like, trying to protect us out there. I mean, it was a pretty dangerous country at times. I remember driving in Conakry, the capital city in Guinea, and we were with this other missionary family. They were in the back seat of our car, and they had a 5-week-old baby and a toddler little boy, and there was some demonstrating going on in the streets from political issues that were going on, and we all of a sudden were just, I was in the front seat with my mom, swarmed by a huge group of people, and they just started picking up rocks and just chucking them at the car, and all the windows were breaking, everything was shattering. My mom pushed me under the dashboard, and just so all the glass wouldn't get in me, and there was screaming and yelling, and my dad was trying to pin it, but, you know, all these people were, like, in front of the car. And anyway, he finally got us into that compound we were staying in, and we were safe. But I remember looking back and seeing that 5-week-old baby was just covered in blood and glass. Mm-hmm. And I actually ended up going to school with those little boys later on. But I think just that constant feeling of them, you know, having to protect their family, their kids, mm-hmm. in that very volatile state, was probably just very exhausting. And but I think also just everything they went through of dealing with, you know, not having any medical help nearby, and holding their 18-month-old, being told to say goodbye to her because she was not supposed to live through the night, with cerebral malaria, and just being robbed countless times. Like, their faith was really put to the test. And I think that I think they're heroes in my eyes, but just they were such good examples to us as kids. So, like, in that way, yeah, I think they're just, I don't know how they did it. And I, you know, when I'm dealing with little petty issues today, like taking my kids to the doctor for a cold or whatever, I don't know how they did it. And yeah, I try to remember that, just, well, they had to fully trust in God. Like, that's all they really had. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I relate to the hero thing. Like, I think of my parents in that way too, in a lot of ways. You know, going into a country where there wasn't a whole lot in terms of support, and, like, with the Iron Curtain having just fallen, right, they were kind of some of the first to actually go into Russia, definitely with SEND International, which is the organization they were with. I think that, like, their what I see of how it made them better people is just the humility that they have, and you know, the kind of what comes along with what you were saying, Jessica, of those sacrifices. Mm-hmm. Definitely echo those. Again, not the same ones because we mm-hmm. didn't have malaria where I was, but but you know, similar themes again of sacrifice. And like, my mom had a baby in the middle of Siberia, mm-hmm. and you know, where she kind of spoke the language but not really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like that that are just so whoa, you know, from a North American Canadian perspective. But they kind of had this sense of, you know, God has called us to this, and God is going to equip us for what it is that we're supposed to do. So they didn't have this attitude, and don't, I would say especially now, don't have this attitude of, oh, well, that's not my gifting, so I can't do that, mm-hmm. right? Like my dad's in mission leadership and now and has been for quite a few years. And, you know, on church boards and in helping disciple pastors and that relational dynamic is definitely him, but the executive, you know, organizational kind of personality mm-hmm. type was totally not him. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't the sense of, oh, I'm not good at this, therefore I won't or can't do it. Mm-hmm. It was just, okay, this is what God's calling me to. These are my honest weaknesses. These are my honest strengths. And, you know, I take it on. And both of my parents having that sort of mentality. I would say in terms of the toll, the isolation that because we really did live quite isolated, mm-hmm. I would say is a big factor. So that sense, which is, even just things like missing out on extended family milestones. Mm-hmm. So I think my mom missed like at least 2 weddings of her nieces and nephews, mm-hmm. like quite a few funerals. And then all just the, you know, quote unquote more mundane mm-hmm. birthday parties and camping trips and things like that. So just not being around at Christmases, mm-hmm. just by virtue of the fact of not being around. So the loss of sort of relational capital with some extended family members. That being said, both of their extended families were very supportive. Yeah, my one aunt and uncle especially, like, they housed me and my brother in our summers between Bible school and Christmases and breaks, and really like treated us like one of their own. And so, you know, that support was there, and that kind of the effort from both sides. But it's just the reality that when you don't live in the same place, you don't participate in the same things. So I think that's definitely one of the losses. And then I think a sense too of third culture kids feel this sense of not belonging, but after being gone for so long, my parents also feel that mm-hmm. And have felt that, you know, we're not at the same stage as our peers. Mm-hmm. We're not,
like,
you know, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, that's a big part of it too, yeah. right? Like, a lot of their peers are looking at, especially your parents, looking at retirement and how do missionaries retire, you know? And, yeah, just the kinds of things that they're involved in. And I think also just that lack of status, too, of their, you know, within church circles, there's a bit of, you know, oh, you're a missionary, but that's changing.
Yeah, it's not what it was.
No, mm-hmm. it's totally not what it was. That's not why they did it, you know, ever, but still that has an effect, mm-hmm. right, on just your self-concept and your sense of worth. I think it can be wearing, I'll put it that way. Like, their faith and their sense of, you know, this is what God has for us is rock solid, but it can still feel lonely.
Okay. Well, thank you. Last question. Speak to other boys and girls who might follow in your footsteps, maybe are. And I always joke that the real podcast audience is worldwide. So you don't know where anyone could be listening from right now. But if you were talking to maybe a young kid who's 6 in their own way and finding out that they're going to go live somewhere else, and the world has changed both in Russia and in Africa from your time. But mm-hmm. nonetheless, what would you say to a little kid or as someone who's starting high school and is about to be uprooted and going to go somewhere else because their parents feel called by God to go somewhere else, what would you say to them? Either they're young or maybe they're a teenager.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a hard one. I guess, you know, to the younger one, you're about to go on a huge adventure and you're going to meet so many amazing people and, you know, grow these amazing relationships, and it'll come with challenges, but in the end, you'll probably love it, because I loved it. I would have loved to raise my kids that same way. I guess the biggest challenge for me was transitioning back. So, you know, I guess I'd say if you ever need anyone to talk with when you come back, you can come chat with me, because you'll probably feel alone, but you're not alone. There are a lot of us who went through it. So, yeah, I don't know, I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Heather Ann, you're actually involved in some of that work. Just tell us a little bit about, before you answer the question, about how you're seeking to give a little bit of your wisdom to future or current TCKs.
Yeah, so there's a organization called the Canadian MK Network that's only about 5 or 6 years old, and it's a I think it's kind of under the umbrella of the MORE Network, which is seeking to equip missionary families and their kids. So one of the things that they do, so yeah, first I would encourage the kid, if they're 16 or via the parents, to get in touch with that organization and kind of be aware of what, you know, resources could be available
to
them.
Okay, we'll post that up in the link on our website when we, yeah, that'd be great.
So one of the things that they do is a reentry camp for missionary kids in that 17 to 20 range. They also do some reentry things for families too, with younger kids. So that's part of it too. But what I've been involved in the last couple of years is for those 17 to 20 year olds. So it's a week long, and there's one that happens in Calgary in August and one that happens in Ontario in July. And so it's a week of unpacking kind of what is TCK MK identity, how does that apply to you, we spend a whole day talking about grief and loss, we spend a whole day talking about relationships and doing relationships in Canada, and
do you teach them about like Snapchat and Instagram?
You know, most of the ones these days don't need that. Yeah, they
you need that.
I know, actually I gave up on Snapchat. It's like, I can't figure this out. And then we do a bunch of fun stuff too, of like the Calgary police comes in and does a presentation, because police is very different all around the world. So how do you interact with police? We've had mental health speakers come in. We've had a guy come in and talk about employment and finances in Canada. Just a whole range of different topics. But really the focus is on the kids and on kind of their journey and transition and equipping them for that. But also kind of giving them some of that wisdom. So I think just the hair on the back of my neck goes up a little bit with thinking about giving advice or what to tell people, because really where I would want to start is with that asking questions of that individual and giving them permission to be an individual, giving them permission to, hey, how are you feeling about this move? You know, it's okay if you're not gung-ho about it. Even though it's building the kingdom, like, it's okay for you to be like, I am really not excited. And just encouraging that honesty and that, along with this, that adventure, like, I totally agree with that too, of, you know what, it's going to be awesome and you're going to belong and be part of a really neat group of people. But it's okay. It's okay that you're not excited, right? So I think just that would be my sense. And then, yeah, just the find your people. Like, find, it's okay to ask for help. You're going to need to ask for help. Again, coming back to that coming back piece, because I think that is really the hardest. I I would maybe refer them to somebody who was older when they moved over, because I can relate to that. And you were born in Cote d'Ivoire. So,
yeah,
you know, the harder transition for us was the coming back. Mm-hmm. But there are other MKs, TCKs out there who have been older when they transitioned. So they would be more able to speak to that. And I would encourage the MK who's older, especially, to talk to somebody who was older when they transitioned. So really reaching out and putting them in touch with resources and being really intentional about that, because TCKs are really good at being like, no, I'm fine, I'm good. Mm-hmm. And they actually appear really good on the outside. Mm-hmm. But being like, no, like, I know what's going on behind the surface. You can't fool me. and just saying, you know what, it's, you might be feeling this way and that's okay. And just giving them permission for that.
Okay. Well, ladies, thanks for your transparency and being real. And it's been, I know a little, I have known a little bit about your stories, but just hearing it straight from you in an extended way has been insightful, and grateful that you're part of our kind of extended family here now. And appreciate you giving us a window into your life, albeit a small one. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to The Real Podcast. For more information on this episode and others, check out our website at cochranealliance.com/real. Until next time, keep it real.